Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. At first, public health officials were clamoring to get diagnostic testing for the novel coronavirus to find out who has it and thereby how to contain it. Now, that is still important. Controlling a pandemic requires knowing how it's spreading across communities and across nations. Call it phase one. Well, now phase two is coming into play. We must also understand how the pathogen works inside individual human bodies. That means different kinds of testing, viral load testing to know how the body reacts to different levels of exposure, antibody testing or serology tests to find out who has had COVID-19 and thereby who might have immunity. Now, that micro-level knowledge helps us make macro-level decisions that can get global society back on track. So this hour on Point, inside the body's response to the novel coronavirus. We're going to begin today with Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's a professor of medicine at Columbia University, a cancer physician and a researcher as well, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His most recent piece is called The One and the Many, and he joins us from New York. Dr. Mukherjee, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So you, in your New Yorker piece, talk about how community-based testing for the novel coronavirus is like getting a bird's-eye view of this pandemic. But you also advocate for what you call a worm's-eye view. What is that worm's-eye view, and why is it important?
Well, so thus far, we have been tracking this pandemic across populations, and that's clearly important. We need to know how the virus is moving across populations, across geographies, across countries. But in order to treat patients and in order to get medicine for patients, we also need to understand what is happening in the individual body of a patient. Why are some patients asymptomatic? Why are some patients reacting? How can we triage patients who have a severe variant or likely to have a severe variant of the disease, and so that we can appropriately get the resources available? And finally, what kind of protective equipment do we need for medical workers and for ordinary people, people who are not in frequent contact with virus but are maybe exposed to someone sitting next to you on the bus? Hmm. All of this requires testing and understanding the dynamics of the virus, not just across populations but within individuals. And what I'm advocating for is that we're reaching a sort of phase two of the epidemic or the pandemic. This phase two involves making much, much more detailed analysis, not a plus-minus analysis, you know, infected, uninfected, asymptomatic, symptomatic, but a quantitative analysis of who is infected, who's not infected, and how we can help them and treat them and how we can triage them so we can best use the limited resources that we're having in this pandemic.
And that treatment and triage knowledge, that studying sort of the immunology or the virology of the novel coronavirus, then arguably that is really important information in terms of getting communities, for example, back to work or when to relax restrictions, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one thing that we don't know yet is, even in the United States, is the extent of the pandemic. Let me give you a very broad example. With a combination of two tests, one is the nasal swab, maybe done twice, to detect whether you're actively infected, and a serology test to see if you have already developed immunity against the virus, you can begin to divide the population into three categories. Category number one would be people who are naive, never seen the virus, don't have infection, and don't have any immunity against the virus. Population two is people who are actively infected, symptomatic or asymptomatic, who are shedding virus in their cough, in their respiratory droplets, and who may become sick in the next, you know, 7, 8, 9 days, or who may be sick already. And population three are people who've had the infection. Maybe they've had a severe course, maybe they've been asymptomatic, but nonetheless they've had virus already and they're developing antibodies against the virus. Just understanding in the community through random testing what the numbers are of population one, two, and three would make us make important policy decisions about what to do, when to do something, when to lift restrictions, who can go back to work, who needs to wear masks, who are the most vulnerable, and so forth. Let me be very, very, very clear. People in virtually all other diseases carry through respiratory infections. The wearing of masks and protective gear, the highest level, which is the N95 respirator and others, should, and gowns and gloves, should be reserved for hospital workers. These are people who are getting the highest dose of virus, and we can quantify that. This is a quantifiable number. We should be reserving those. But I also believe that the common, for common exposures, grocery store interactions, going to the bodega, et cetera, would require masks, social isolation, hand hygiene and decontamination. And if we put all of this into place in an orderly manner, we could dramatically reduce the amount of exposure for ordinary people and dramatically reduce the severity of disease based on what we know from other viruses. I should say that we don't know for this particular virus because we haven't tested it. We are fighting against time. And so the longer we can prevent the overcrowding of hospitals, the burdens on the intensive care units and on the medical doctors, the better it is for everyone.
Agreed. Well, so regarding what we need or want to learn about how the novel coronavirus works inside the human body, inside individual bodies. You make a point about sort of gaining a dynamic understanding of something as seemingly straightforward as viral load. So what do we mean by viral load and why is it important?
A viral load is just a quantitative measure of how much virus you have in your body. We use this I'm a virologist by training, although I'm a cancer physician. In clinical practice, by training, I'm a viral immunologist. A viral load is a critical parameter we've seen in other viruses, influenza, HIV, SARS, not SARS-CoV-2, but the original SARS, et cetera, to understand how much virus you have in your secretions, in your body, and to be able to understand what the exposure level is of a human being. A viral load, the simplest way to think about it is to say a viral load is akin to the dose of a poison. Or another way to think about it is, in radiation, we don't classify people exposed to radiation as saying, they've been exposed or not exposed. We ask the question, how much, quantitatively, how much radiation have they been exposed to? Similarly, when we assess the dose or the exposure to a poison, we say how much, what is the quantitative amount of poison you have in your body? And the viral load is basically the same thing. It is treating the virus as a quantitative phenomenon, not a qualitative phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's not just an on and off. It is how much have you had and what is the relationship between that amount and the severity of the disease that you're likely to experience.
And Dr. Mukherjee, you also write interestingly that there's a point in the progression of any virally caused illness called peak viremia, right, which is the highest amount of the virus in the body, but that different people reach that peak viremia at different times based on their individual immune systems and physiology.
That's right. So the viral load or the peak viremia is just half the equation.
Yeah.
The other half of the equation is your individual immune response. Some people respond for reasons we don't understand. Some people can produce antibodies and other cells against the virus early. Some people take a longer time. We need to discriminate between those people. Why is all of this important? Because we need, in this time, we are in April right now, we need to buy us time to get the drugs that we need that will change the face of the epidemic. The only way out of this economic crisis, the financial crisis, and the devastation it's caused around the world is to have an effective medicine and ultimately an effective vaccine. Medicines take, 6 to 8 months. In the fastest track that it's available, it might take 3 to 4 months. Vaccines take 12 to 18 months, and we can discuss why, but the vaccine is not going to come tomorrow. So in this time, our job is to buy the medical personnel time, is to keep them safe so that they can tend to the sickest people, and to take social responsibility ourselves to stop the spread of the virus in our communities so that we can buy us time to do these clinical trials. A medicine against COVID-19 would completely transform the landscape and the panic and the worry about this disease. And so I'm speaking now as a medical professional, buy us time, be socially responsible, wear a mask, sanitize yourself, keep social distancing, and buy us time to be able to run these trials so that we get the right kind of drugs and the right kind of people, and we can really transform the passage of this pandemic as it moves through the United States.
Well, Siddhartha Mukherjee is a professor of medicine at Columbia University. He is an oncologist and a staff writer for The New Yorker. His recent piece in The New Yorker magazine was titled The One and the Many. And Professor Mukherjee is also, by the way, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Emperor of All Maladies. His latest book is called The Gene, An Intimate History, which, by the way, has been turned into a film by Ken Burns, which began airing on PBS yesterday. Dr. Mukherjee, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, and be safe.
You too. When we come back, we'll talk with a medical researcher who's been looking into coronaviruses for decades, and we'll also talk with one of the leading journalists on infectious diseases as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about why it's important to understand how the novel coronavirus works inside individual bodies and how that knowledge will help us make decisions on the levels of communities, states, and even nations about getting the world back on its feet following this global pandemic. Well, I'm joined today now by Helen Branswell. She's joining us via Skype from Boston, Massachusetts. She's infectious diseases and global health reporter for Stat News. Helen, it's good to talk with you.
Hi, Meghna.
It's great to have you. And how are you doing, by the way?
I'm fine. It's it's a gray day here in Boston, but that's okay. I'm well.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, also joining us now is Dr. Stanley Perlman. He's a professor of microbiology, immunology, and pediatrics at the University of Iowa, and he studied coronaviruses for nearly 40 years. Dr. Perlman, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, Helen, let me first actually start with you, and then I'm going to dig deep with Dr. Perlman about coronaviruses. How would you describe why it's important for us to really understand this micro-level behavior of the novel coronavirus in a human body?
Well, I mean, one of the things, if we're talking here about immunity, which is, I think, where we're going, one of the things we really want to know is how many people have actually been infected with this virus as it has passed through in this first wave of infections, because clearly it's important to get a sense of who is still at risk. Obviously, we also need to find out if people have been infected, how long they might have some immunity and might be able to safely go back out into the community, and whether, you know, even if they could be infected on a second or third time, whether their later infections might not be as severe. These are all critical questions that need to be answered as we try to figure out how to live with this virus, which is clearly establishing itself among us.
Okay. And Dr. Perlman, I'm just curious what your answer is to that same question about why this is so important.
Yeah, I agree with the answers that Helen said. We need to know who is infected, whether they can be reinfected. One of the things I think about this disease is on a second round, one of the points that was just mentioned, is that our goal is really twofold, not necessarily to keep people from being reinfected, but rather to keep them from developing severe disease that requires any hospital intervention, and also to make it so that they can't transmit the virus to other people. So those are really the two goals, even if we can't prevent what's called sterilizing immunity, which means that the person will never get infected by the virus at any level.
Okay. So, Dr. Perlman, as I mentioned, you have been studying coronaviruses for four decades now, almost four decades?
Almost four decades.
So that includes what, SARS, MERS, and this novel coronavirus. How does this one compare to other coronaviruses you've studied?
Yeah, so I should say that in the first 20 years of my career, I studied a mouse coronavirus. And the reason that I'm mentioning that, it's one of the things that I studied it for, is that it caused what's called immunopathological disease. So what this means and what we observe is this particular virus that we studied, this coronavirus, infected the brain. And it actually infected the cells that make myelin. That's the white matter that covers axons and helps in transmission in a simple way of thinking about it. And the mice, when infected with this virus, their myelin could be completely infected. Every bit of myelin could be infected. But if they didn't have an immune response, the mice actually didn't care very much. But then if you allowed them to have an immune response, in this case, the cellular basis of the immune response, T cells, then within a few days, they had complete myelin destruction and virus was cleared. So the host was unable to clear the virus without causing lots of damage to the myelin and to the host. We studied it because it was a disease that resembled the human disease, multiple sclerosis. So then when SARS and MERS came about, we still work on murine coronaviruses, but we switched our gears over to SARS and MERS. And both of these diseases, and probably SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 have the same kind or a very similar kind of immunopathological basis. So it seems as if people get worse as virus starts being cleared. As the immune system cuts in and clears the virus, that's when you start getting severe disease. And it also means that that's responsible for a large part of the disease that we see in later stages of people who have severe disease.
So the immune system's response is as much a potential problem in terms of how people are experiencing the disease, is what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, yes.
Okay. Well, so what does that understanding in and of itself give us? Does that give us a tool in terms of how we might try and develop therapeutics or medicines for this?
Yeah, well, I think that for a lot of us who have been in the field for a while, we think that the way you want to do this is you want to eliminate a virus as early as you can during the disease course. And then once virus is clearly under control, then you want to do something to target the immune response so it's not so pathogenic, not so lethal to the person. But you have to have the two together. One of the biggest problems that occurred in the SARS epidemic is that this was the same kind of thinking that was done in 2003. A drug called ribavirin was used to knock down the virus load. And then corticosteroids, which are well known to be broadly immunosuppressive, was added. And the problem with the approach was twofold. ribavirin actually didn't affect the virus replication at all. So virus didn't care that ribavirin was there. And then the corticosteroids too broadly knocked down the immune response. And in fact, in large meta-analyses or analyses that were done years after the epidemic ended, we found that that combination actually was worse for patients than doing nothing, which also points out why it's so key to have controlled studies for these kinds of drugs or any intervention, because even though something makes sense, it may not work and it may be actually have negative effects.
Okay. So you have, Dr. Perlman, in your lab right now, do I have this right? You actually have samples of the novel coronavirus that you're doing testing on.
Yeah. So we work with the SARS-CoV-2. We work with SARS-CoV. We work with MERS-CoV. We work with all of them.
What kind of questions are you asking about the SARS-CoV-2, about the novel coronavirus?
Well, I think that we're following up on some of the information we have from SARS and MERS. So right now in the lab, the first thing we're doing is we like to do our studies in mice so we can actually have a more complicated system than working just with cells. So far we don't have an animal model that replicates COVID-19 as well as we would like, but we're working on that. And then once we have that, what we like to do is test different interventions and see if they help protect the mouse against infection. And when can you do these interventions? When we did similar studies with MERS and SARS infected mice, we know that interventions are really needed early if you're going to prevent a severe disease. And that's, I think, been borne out in the human disease too. Interventions don't work well if you wait until a person's sick, even modestly sick. You want to catch them as early as you can.
Mm. So Helen Branswell, I mean, what are the kinds of questions that you think we as the general public need to ask or need to have answered to better understand how we should be making decisions going forward about managing this pandemic?
Well, I mean, as Dr. Perlman was just saying, I mean, finding out what works against this and when you can start to use it and who you need to use it in would be really, really critical to sort of prevent people from going on to having severe disease. I'd like to know more about why it is that many people have very mild symptoms. Some people have almost nothing. And then other people go on to have very acute and even fatal infections. You know, we know that it's true that people in their 60s, 70s and beyond have a much higher risk of a bad outcome. And also people who have some chronic conditions like diabetes or, you know, severe obesity, their risks are much higher as well. But, you know, you hear about people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, not as many, but some who are seemingly, you know, perfectly healthy when they contract this and go on to die. And knowing why so many people can control the infection, don't get to the point where their immune system sort of goes into overdrive, and why others can't would really be very helpful, I think.
Mm. Well, Dr. Perlman, since you've been studying these coronaviruses for so long, are there any lessons or comparisons that we could be making to, say, the coronavirus that causes SARS?
Yeah, so I think the main difference between what we're seeing with COVID-19 and SARS was actually in the upper respiratory tract infection. So this kind of puts a whole new variable on it. So if you think about SARS, this was a disease of the lower lungs, and we know that every 100 people who got infected, every 100, all of them had symptoms, and 10 of them died from the infection. But there wasn't an appreciable upper airway infection that we noticed. It probably occurred in order for the virus to get to the lungs, though we're not even certain of that. And so even though it uses the same receptor on cells to get into cells, the SARS-CoV-2 and SARS-CoV behave really differently in terms of the upper airway. And so one way to think about COVID-19 is that of the patients who get severe disease, and we think they're about 15 or 20%, those are people who have infection in their lungs. And if you use that as your denominator, 15 or 20%, and then you have 3% mortality of the total, it comes out to about a 20% mortality. So what I'm trying to say is that SARS-CoV by itself infected only the lungs, had about a 10% mortality, and severe disease, or greater than that, of course. And then SARS-CoV-2, of the severe disease, it has 20% mortality of those who get really severe lung disease. So the key difference is actually in the upper airway. And then it comes back to why do, and this is a part that we are very interested in, and I think everybody is. So of the people who get infected in the upper airway, why does the virus seem to stay in the upper airway with minimal infection of the lungs? Because that's what we think happens. There's not that much infection. And why does the virus end up being able to invade the lungs in those 15% or 20% who get more severe disease? And we don't know whether this is because of the what the receptor on the virus is doing with the receptor on the cell, or this is, or there's some sort of underlying subtle differences in the genetics of people who get more severe disease. As Helen mentioned, it certainly is an issue with the underlying comorbidities. Mm-hmm. That tends to make it worse for everybody. Anybody who has that is more likely to get a severe disease.
So all of those questions that you just asked, it, to my mind, it would seem that it's very important to have answers, or at least the beginnings of answers to those questions, in order to develop effective therapeutics for COVID-19. And at the beginning of the show, Dr. Mukherjee was talking about how ideally we would have a, 6 to 8 month development period for some of these new medicines. Does that make sense? Will we get the kind of answers we need to have that timeline for new therapeutics?
Yeah, you know, and it may not be, and yes, we I think people are developing therapeutics, but really a key question is when to use them.
Uh-huh.
Because I like the analogy of influenza and Tamiflu. So we know that if somebody has influenza and we treat them at the very earliest stage with Tamiflu, they do better. They may not even have much of a flu disease. But if we wait until 2 or 3 days, then it's likely that adding Tamiflu will maybe shorten their clinical disease by half a day. It won't make a big difference. So it matters giving people medicine early. And that's true for this disease as well. So to my mind, the idea, what I would like to see is an oral medicine. I mean, this is all my dreams. We have nothing here now. But if we had an oral medicine that we could give to people who had mild disease, and if the medicine was safe and inexpensive, then we can treat everyone, even the 85% who may not need therapy. But if it worked well, then you'd prevent disease in the other 15% and avoid hospitalization. Mm. And for those who then developed severe disease, even while taking this medicine, then we'd know that those patients, if they went to the hospital, then we would want to be able to measure virus load, as was discussed. And at that point, we might want to treat the immune response to try to prevent severe consequences of the infection.
Right. Well, let's go quickly to one of our callers. Let's go to Stephanie, who's calling from Wrentham, Massachusetts. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi. I really appreciate the work that both of your guests are doing. This is really important work. But I have a sort of perhaps foundational or more practical immediate question, and that is I'm wondering to what extent we know how reliable the tests are. That is, we're counting on the tests telling us what we need to know about who has it and who doesn't. But I heard the other day on NPR that 30% of the tests were giving us false negative results. Mm-hmm. And certainly that's problematic for everybody who assumes that if they're not positive, then they're in good shape. But I also am wondering about the false positive rate and what that does for perhaps confusing the information about who's going to provide the information that these doctors need for their research.
Well, so let's turn that question. Stephanie, thank you so much. Foundational questions are important. They provide the foundation for our understanding. So Helen Branswell, is there a high false negative rate for the current testing of active infections?
Yeah, I'm going to have to flip that one to Dr. Perlman.
Oh,
I'm not
okay.
Sure. I feel confident to answer that question. There are so many tests, and I haven't really seen a good breakdown of what the specificity and sensitivity of those tests are.
Sure.
Do you know, Dr. Perlman?
Yeah, so I would go back a step because there's so many tests on the market, and they're all not evaluated side by side. So we don't really know what works well and what doesn't work well. But I would say from our knowledge of what's going on with this testing, I have the most experience with testing for MERS. And what we found was that the tests that were commercially available, and there was only one, so it's much simpler, that test tended to be not very sensitive. So it missed a lot of positives. We found it to be fairly specific, so it didn't pick up false positives. But others have said it also picks up false positives. With these coronavirus tests, with any serology, what you have to do is you want to avoid picking up community-acquired coronaviruses, which shouldn't be too hard because they don't really cross-react that much. But probably even more importantly, you just don't want to pick up random false positives. And of course, false negatives are equally problematic, and it depends on the sensitivity. So the commercial test for MERS was not very sensitive. So this is why these tests, there are so many on the market, but they have to really be carefully evaluated, and somebody has to do them side by side with samples of antibodies from people who have seen the cold or the community-acquired coronaviruses, as well as with other respiratory infections. So sorting this out, I think, is a big deal and is very important. And of course, also different people may have different antibody responses. Some may have more potent ones that'll be easier to measure. The other thing we found with MERS is that people who had mild disease were asymptomatic. The antibody responses tended to be transient. So if you measured the response a year later, you would think they'd never been infected, but they had been infected.
Dr. Perlman, hold on to that thought because that's really interesting, and I want to pick it up when we come back. Really talking more about antibodies when it comes to coronaviruses. So Dr. Stanley Perlman and Helen Branswell, hang on for a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are trying to understand this hour how the novel coronavirus works inside individual human bodies, or the questions that we need answered about that issue, because understanding that will hopefully help us then apply that knowledge across communities, across nations, to get the world back on its feet after this coronavirus pandemic. And I'm joined today by Stanley Perlman. He's professor of microbiology, immunology, and pediatrics at the University of Iowa. He studied different coronaviruses for nearly 40 years. And Helen Branswell also joins us. She's an infectious diseases and global health reporter for Stat News, has written all about multiple infectious diseases, everything from bird flu to the H1N1 flu pandemic, Ebola, Zika. She's leading Stat's coverage of the coronavirus pandemic. And by the way, folks, I want to let you know that tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking to Michael Schur. He's the creator of NBC's The Good Place. So we're going to be stepping away from science and looking at ethics and morality in a time of a global pandemic like the novel coronavirus. And so are you thinking about what it means to be good or what our moral obligations are to each other? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Now, coming back to today, Helen, so are we at a stage where we're ramping up testing, or ideally would be ramping up testing, on people who have evidence of antibodies to the novel coronavirus?
Yeah, so that is the next frontier, and it has started. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, said on the weekend that they have already started a study trying to get at what percentage of people might actually have been infected. It's clear that not all cases have come to light, either because people who felt ill couldn't get a test, or because this virus seems to infect some people so mildly they don't even recognize that they're ill. And finding out how big that portion of people is really crucial, as we were saying earlier. So the CDC is starting to do those kinds of tests. Other groups will also start to do those kinds of tests, both in the United States and elsewhere, trying to get a sense of really how big this wave of infection has been to sort of plan for the future. But I mean, it also opens up really important questions about, if you find antibody, how long the antibody lasts. Dr. Yeah. Perlman was referring that to that before. And that's critical to know, both in terms of future risk, but also what we might be able to expect in terms of developing a vaccine. And could you get a vaccine that induces a what's called a durable immune response, something that will last for more than just, say, a season or so.
So, Dr. Perlman, you had started to say that in the case of MERS, it was, what, a year later that retesting people for antibodies? Was it that there were no antibodies in their system a year later, or what? Explain that to me.
Yeah, so what we did is we actually looked 6 months later, and people had either mild disease or subclinical infection or even mild pneumonia. They often had lost their antibody response. So,
but
and then it would stay, it wouldn't be there when we tested 24 months later either. So it was really gone.
I was jumping in, but weren't longer. Wasn't the durability of antibody quite a bit longer for SARS-1, the 2003 outbreak?
Yeah, so that's it's a bit of a complicated answer, because the first study done at 6 years saw that patients who had SARS had no antibody left. But in fact, we have redone that. We haven't published it yet, but we've redone that 18 years later, and we find some of the patients still do have antibodies. So where we stand is not totally clear. I think the same bottom line, that some people develop good antibody responses and some don't. There's also another part of the immune system that's equally important. So this is, I mentioned a little bit earlier, the cell-mediated response, or the T-cell response.
Yeah.
These are the cells that, instead of mopping up the virus in the blood or in fluid, actually destroys infected cells so they can't make more virus. And we found that these responses, in the case of MERS, even in people who had lost their antibody responses, their T-cell responses were not apparent, or were apparent, sorry. They were apparent. They were there at detectable levels. So what I'm trying to say here is that if people who had had the infection, most of them saw the infection at some level. They had a T cell response, which might be partly protective. And that might give us hope that even for these patients who had antibodies and lost it, that they still have parts of their immune system, what are called memory B cells, that could be quickly reenacted or quickly reactivated to make antibody if they were infected again. So this would be the good news of patients who had been infected with the virus. But for prevalence studies or trying to figure out who is infected, who can go back to work, if the antibody is going to disappear, this is very hard. T cell measurements are not easy, and we rely on these antibody measurements. So this is the kind of subtleties that we have to think about as we think about antibody testing and how to use the information.
Okay, so then you're seeing, though, as Helen mentioned, that there are plans to roll out antibody testing in the United States. Finland says it's going to start doing randomized antibody testing. It seems like, nevertheless, though, that's going to provide us useful information, Dr. Perlman, is it not?
Yes. So, okay. But the key part is that you have a good test. So if you have a test that's doing what you want, it's specific and sensitive, then it's exactly what you want. You know, to another
wait, actually, Dr. Perlman, before you go, so sorry to interrupt, but do we have a good test for antibodies then?
Yeah, that's the question. I don't know that we do right now. We might, but not, I haven't seen anything so well validated that you can say yes, that you can take a group of people who are infected, aren't infected, we know they don't have community coronaviruses, No, they have had community coronaviruses. Do all the right testing to be sure your test is as good as it can be.
Okay. I, I don't know what to do with that knowledge, right? Because perhaps I found myself inappropriately putting some hope in the idea that we'd be moving to a phase where we'd be looking for what immunity means through this antibody testing. Is it a false hope?
Yeah, no, I think that hope is exactly what we all have. It's just that from our experience with MERS, we just want to be careful and make sure that people are doing all the right testing. You know, you can think back to the HIV era when serology was so important for identifying people who are infected. And we worked very hard to make a test that was considered reliable, sensitive, and specific. So we didn't miss people, and we didn't pick up people who weren't HIV infected. And we did an ELISA followed by Western blots to make it just right. And that's the kind of thinking we have to do here. We just have to make sure that we're satisfied. So the specificity, picking up only true positives, and the sensitivity, picking them all up, is there. That's all I'm really saying.
Okay. Well, so Helen, then reflect with me on what Dr. Perlman just said and how we should then understand, as you were saying, like the CDC says it's going to start testing for coronavirus antibodies. What does that mean?
Well, first of all, they're starting in places that are hotspots, sort of places where you would have had a good expectation that perhaps a lot of people have been infected. So places like New York City and Seattle, for instance. You know, what Dr. Perlman is saying is effectively, as a lot of different groups develop and roll out tests, it is going to be just as it's important to have a sense of how good the tests are to pick up acute infection, the ones that are being used now to detect cases, you're going to have a sense of how good the antibody tests are. And, you know, you have to assume that, you know, some will be better than others, and they have to be sort of validated and shown so that we know which ones work. I mean, at some point in time, and this is not going to be anytime soon, you know, I can imagine that a commercial test will be available that you can take at home, you know, a few years from now, in the way that gene testing has been very popular of late, the type of thing people gave to other people for Christmas, I can imagine you might actually, you know, be able to order and send off a test to determine whether or not you've been previously infected. But that's not now. In the meantime, you know, the research tests that are being developed will give us some handle. But I think in the early days, you know, with different groups using different tests, it'll take a while for a sort of a consolidated picture to come into view. I mean, people might get divergent results, and that's to be expected, I guess. But, you know, these are answers we really need.
Right. We don't have the answers yet. So I just want to acknowledge that I appreciate both of you sort of helping us walk through the fog of not knowing right now. There are no hard and fast answers at the moment, even though I'm asking you questions that are hopefully leading. I have this desire for hard and fast answers, but I absolutely know that they do not yet exist, and that's why we're trying to explore all this together. So let's go to Ted, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Ted, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I am a clinical virologist, a board certified in clinical virology. And I've been practicing for over 40 years, and my specialty also is molecular infectious diseases, which is using molecular methodologies to detect and diagnose infectious diseases in individuals. And I'd like to make a couple of comments. First, one goes back to Dr. Mukherjee's statements about viral load. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned viremia, and viremia is only the detection of virus in the blood. And that's not particularly useful in the case of COVID-19. We do know you can find the virus in the blood, but what it means right now is very much up in the air. And it's extremely difficult to do viral load testing from nasal swabs, throat swabs, or nasopharyngeal swabs because those are very technique dependent and people collect the samples in very different ways. So trying to get viral load, meaningful viral load data out of those is very, very difficult. One of your people on the phone asked about the sensitivity and specificity of the tests being used now, false positives and false negatives. The Federal Drug Administration has set very high standards for those of us in the laboratory who have developed our own tests. And the laboratory that I direct right now has is using a commercially available test, but is also developing its own test and following those standards. And the main problem is not necessarily the test being false positive because the test is bad, but in the collection. As
right.
I mentioned, throat swabs, nasopharyngeal swabs, and nasal swabs are very, very technique dependent. And over the years, I've seen nurses and physicians who can collect these extremely well and those who collect them extremely poorly.
Yeah.
And that makes a major difference on how and how well those tests will be resulted.
Right. So, Ted, I'm just going to jump in here because I want to note that in Siddhartha Mukherjee's piece in The New Yorker, he actually had quite a long section about exactly what you're talking about, that methodology or the actual collection of the sample is one of the chief causes of maybe unreliable results in this kind of testing. So your point is really well taken. Just very briefly, Ted, since you're a clinical virologist, what is one of you think the most important questions that we want answers to right now about how this novel coronavirus works in the body? What do you want to know?
In terms of treating patients, this novel coronavirus seems to not just be a respiratory disease, but also seems to be affecting other organs, such as the heart. And that seems to be an issue with certain patients and how the virus is actually affecting the heart and what part of the heart is right now, I think, important in terms of treating patients, especially if you're going to use hydroxyquinolone, which does have effects on the heart itself. So that's something that's very important. And also, Dr. Perlman point about the immune response and the types of immune cascades we're seeing, which can affect patients in a very, very deleterious manner, where the virus isn't necessarily killing the patient, but the patient's own immune system is killing the patient.
Right. Well, Ted, I'm going to take it back from you because I'm just running out of time here. But thank you so much for that call. Dr. Perlman, let me turn back to you now because we do have just a minute and a half left. And I want you to help us understand, like, as lay people, when we read these reports about antibody testing or how the virus, what we're learning about how it works in the body, what are the questions we should be asking? How should we be processing this information?
Well, in terms of the antibody testing, I think that the question that I would want people to ask is just how good are these data? Because that's the way we make our decisions. And that has been the point that I've been making about the testing. Once we have tests that are good, then I think that we have really clear things we want to know. You know, who can go back to work? Who's going to be potentially get infected again, who will be contagious if he or she gets a minor infection. So having the testing is really a fundamental point of that. And the other question was about, say that part again, the first part of your question.
Oh, no, you answered it just fine about sort of the quality of the data. That was a perfect answer to the question. And Helen, since you have been following this so closely, same thing to you. What do you still want to know about this particular virus?
I mean, I think I mentioned it earlier. I would really like to have a better understanding why some people who seemingly have no elevated risk that we've been able to identify, why they can't control the virus and sort of tumble into this very severe illness and whether or not that could be prevented.
Yeah. So all of it leads to me to also wondering, like, we should continue to try and we are continuing to try to understand what immunity actually means with this novel coronavirus as well. But Helen Branswell, infectious diseases and global health reporter for Stat News, leading Stat's coverage of the coronavirus pandemic. Helen, thank you so much for your reporting and for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Dr. Stanley Perlman, professor of microbiology, immunology and pediatrics at the University of Iowa. Dr. Perlman, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.